Hello, I'm R.A. Spratt. I write and perform this podcast. If you'd like to support the show, I'm a children's author, so you can buy a book by me, or you can buy me a coffee by going to buymeacoffee.com/storiesrasspratt. It's an easy way to make a small thank you gift to the show so I can keep kicking this can down the road. The podcast directory you're using right now should have a link to my Buy Me a Coffee page in the show notes, or you can type it into your browser. That's buymeacoffee.com/storiesrasspratt. All contributions are gratefully appreciated. Hello and welcome to Bedtime Stories with me, R.A. Spratt. Okay, so this is the big 10th anniversary of Friday Barnes special edition, because Friday Barnes 12 Collision Course has just come out. And, you know, I had a read-in on the podcast last week from that book, and the week before we had a read-in from the previous book. So to celebrate that, and to celebrate the fact that it's 4 years of doing this podcast, 4 years this week or next week, I think it is, I thought we'd do a Q&A. You must have a bunch of questions brimming in your minds. So people have been sending me questions all week. I'm now holding up the questions as though you can see them. Well, there is actually going to be a video. So if you want to see this Q&A, you'll be able to go to my website, raspratt.com, and watch a video of me saying all these things I'm saying to you now via the podcast. So anyway, I'm waving this at the camera. This is a huge stack of questions. I'm not sure what I was thinking when I said, email me your questions. I mean, I know that tens of thousands of you listen every week, but I don't know what I was thinking, because obviously a lot of people have sent in a lot of questions. I hope we get through as many as possible today. I can't promise we'll get to all of them. Some of the questions, they do repeat a little bit. So hopefully if I don't actually answer your specific question and say your name, you'll get your question answered. Anyway, thank you for writing in and taking the time. And let's just get stuck in, because as I say, there are a lot of questions here to get through. I've set aside about 40 minutes to do this, because I figure you'll get bored of listening to me after about 40 minutes. I've just bumped the table. If you were wondering what that noise was, I bumped it with my knee. So let's get into it. Here we go. Question one, it's from Brielle, and she asks, will a TV series of Friday Barnes ever come? I like the way you phrased that. It was very dramatic. Well, the thing is, I would love for there to be a TV series of Friday Barnes, if for no other reason that if they did make a television series of it, I would make a lot of money. And frankly, I would like to make a lot of money at this stage of my career. I would find that very enjoyable. The problem is, like, kids ask me all the time, you know, will there be a Friday Barnes movie? Will there be a Nanny Piggins TV series? That sort of thing. As though I have any control over that. I really don't, because the thing is, when people make a television series, it costs a lot of money to make. So if you were going to make a television series that was animated, I know I worked on a low to medium budget feature film last year. I was editing the script for these guys. And the budget for a low to medium budget animated feature film was $15 million. That might have been $15 million US as well. And you think about it, that's a low budget film. So $15 million is a lot of money. And you think, in Australia, the average home is worth about $1 million. So if you're trying to persuade someone to give you $15 million to make a television series or a film, it's like going to 15 people and saying, give me your house. And I promise in 5 years' time, after I've made this incredibly labor-intensive feature film, there is a 50-50 chance I might be able to give you the same amount of money back. And, you know, like your parents, if you've got a house, they probably really like their house and they would be reluctant to just give it to someone, particularly a crazy creative writer. So persuading someone to give you that massive amount of money, like 15 houses worth of money, is a lot of work. And like, I'm good at telling stories. I'm not good at persuading people who have a lot of money to give me their money. In fact, I'm the type of person, you know, like I just make up stuff all the time and just say really, you know, crazy, kooky stories. I'm really the last person someone should be giving large amounts of money to. I mean, you know, these books and stories would make great TV series and movies, but unfortunately, the type of people who have lots of money, they have lots of money because they're sensible and they have never given it to someone like me. So The reason there is not a TV series of Friday Bunts, it's not because of anything I have said or done. It's just that the people who have the money and the power to do like things like that have more common sense. Anyway, so if you do know someone with the power to make a film or a TV series, great. Tell them to make my thing. That would be great. But I don't think I can persuade them. All right. Nicole has asked, will you ever do a Pandora's Box episode of Nanny Piggins with Nanny Piggins telling the story? That is actually a really great suggestion. It is on my list because I actually have to do a whole bunch more Greek myths for the podcast in the next few months because my publisher has asked me to write a collection of short stories of Greek myths based on the podcast. So I've already got six up my sleeve from ones we've already done, but I've got to write another six between now and August. So Pandora's Box, that's a really good suggestion. I've got a few other ideas of things that I can do. Like there's some really cool stories we haven't got into yet, like Jason and the Golden Fleece. And we haven't done all of Hercules' labors yet. So there's a bunch of other things we can get into. We've never done the story of Ariadne and Theseus in the labyrinth. We've done both ends of it. We've done Theseus before the labyrinth, and we've done the labyrinth with Daedalus and Icarus afterwards, but we haven't done the famous story in between, which is Theseus wrestling with the Minotaur in the labyrinth. So there's lots of Greek myths we haven't done, but Pandora's Box would be really cool. Pandora is such a cool character. When I get to that, you'll all find out, but it's such a brilliant idea for a character. The ancient Greeks just had some crackingly good story ideas. So yeah, I will get to that. And then you'll all be able to talk. Once you've heard the story, you'll understand what a Pandora's box is. And then you'll all be able to talk about, oh, you've opened a Pandora's box, and you'll sound very educated. All right. Next question is from Warren. And Warren asks, is there another Pesky Kids book? Well, there's five in the series, and I read all five onto the podcast. And basically, no, there will not be another Pesky Kids book. And it's not for lack of love on my part. Well, it's two things. One, when I wrote the Pesky Kids, it's the only series I've ever written where I knew what the end point would be, which is getting out and the wedding at the end. So I knew that that was going to be the whole arc of the whole series, the sort of journey with the kids, meeting their father, realizing that it wasn't their father's fault that he had to leave, and then getting to know their father, getting to know the town, and then their mother coming back and then reconciling who their mother really is and how that's going to work for them as a family. Like that was going to be the whole arch of the five books. So that journey was complete. Like five books is not a small amount of books. So I really do feel like I did my job, and it was nice to have an arc that I was working towards. So there's lots of like Easter eggs in that book series because I always knew that's where I was going with that series. So I do think it's like complete as a set of stories. But really the main reason there will never be any more Pesky Kids books is the books just didn't sell. And it just comes down to that because I can't write books unless I'm making money from writing books. And if people don't buy the books, I get 10% basically of every book that sells. And if people aren't buying the books, I just can't afford to write books that I don't make money from because this is my job. And the publisher doesn't want to publish books that don't sell. So, unfortunately, there'll be no more Pesky Kids books because of that. But on the bright side, because it wasn't a huge seller, it meant I got to read the whole series onto the podcast and the publisher didn't mind. So it's a swings and roundabout situation. It's a shame, but as I say, five books is actually a lot. So the glass half full way of looking at it is, yay, there were five Pesky Kids books. Isn't that awesome? I always like to try and look at things in a glass half full kind of way. All right. So this is Sophia. She's 11 and she's asked me, who is your muse for Friday Bunts? Well, muse, that's another reference to Greek mythology. The muses are an idea from Greek mythology. So muse is like the inspiration. It's not necessarily the person that technically the idea of a muse is not necessarily like the person that the character is based on. It's sort of like a person who inspires the character. So Friday's a complicated character. The starting point, bang the table again. Let's see how many times I can do that in the next 40 minutes. The starting point for Friday Bunts was me going to my local Big W, which is a discount department store, and trying to think what type of book could I write that would sell really well. And I looked at romance, I looked at cookbooks, I looked at all these different things, but I decided I'd write mystery novels. And one of the most famous type of mystery novels, one of the first mystery novels of all time was Edgar Allan Poe actually wrote some with a very similar character, but Sherlock Holmes was the one I knew first. So Sherlock Holmes And it's, Friday Barnes is basically, the idea when I wrote Friday Barnes was to take the character of Sherlock Holmes, who is someone who's very scientific and very logical and reasoned in the way they think, and that's how they solve problems. But the problem is they're so logical and scientific, but they have terrible social skills and they irritate everyone. That's basically Sherlock Holmes, which is a book written, I'm going to say 130 years ago. Like it's a, so I took that idea from Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, that idea of someone who thinks very scientifically, but is emotionally inept. And I thought, I will take that idea and I will use that for Friday Barnes. So basically take Sherlock Holmes and make her an 11-year-old girl. So that was the sort of kickoff point. But then I was, when I was at high school, I went to a selective school. And when I was in primary school for my last 2 years at primary school, I was in an opportunity class, an OC class. So I had 8 years of selective education where I was surrounded by super smart kids. And a lot of them had very academic parents who literally were academics at universities and very smart parents. And they came from these super smart families and environments. So I was in a sea when I was at high school of 750 super smart kids, many of whom, really most of whom, were quite eccentric. So Friday Barnes, she's the kickoff point, the starting point was Sherlock Holmes, but then it was informed by all these kids I knew at school who were these girls who were very, very bright and intellectual. And also a lot of the emotional stuff comes from me, from my feelings being in a school and not feeling, because I have very poor social skills. Like if you met me in person, I'm not good at eye contact and I'm not good at saying appropriate things in appropriate times and I get a bit overwhelmed sometimes. So a lot of that emotional stuff comes from me. So it's an amalgam of all those things, Friday Barnes. And she probably has become more me and less Sherlock Holmes as I've gone along. But at heart, if you're trying to write a character fluently, I always find the best way to write a character and be consistent about who they are is to get in your head, how do they think? And Friday thinks like a scientist. And then sometimes she's overwhelmed by her emotions, but she doesn't understand that. So it's almost like she gets sick. Like for her, it's almost like symptoms of sickness when she gets emotional because she doesn't understand what's going on. Okay, next question is from Maddie. And she's asking, Friday Barnes 12 is the largest Friday Barnes book or will there be a 13? Okay, I think that's a typo. I think she's asking, is Friday Barnes 12 the last Friday Barnes book or will there be a 13? Well, actually, I can give you a hot piece of news fresh off the press, something that's been established this week. I think technically I have signed a confidentiality agreement saying I shouldn't say this, but I don't think it's a big secret really. Yes, there will be a 13. I've been telling everyone there'll be a 13 for a year. So I don't think that's a big secret because my publisher has literally sat in an audience and heard me tell people there will be a 13. But the thing that I can confirm this week is there will also be a 14. So there's going to be 13 and 14. I've been commissioned to write those. I have signed a contract. So it will happen. I was keen to just do 13, but the publisher was keen for 14. So I'm like, okay, let's do this. Let's make this happen. That's the third time I bumped the table, by the way, if you're keeping count. So there's definitely going to be 13 and 14. I've got a bit of an idea what's going to happen in 13. I've got some ideas cooking away. Not sure what's going to happen in 14, but we'll get there. I do know that 14 will be the end of this set of books. So the first 8 books take place at Highcrest Academy, and then this set, 6 books, all with like the museums and everything in Europe, and you know, Interpol and all that, with them a couple of years older, like 15 and 16 years old. I'm going to wrap that up with book 14. Now, I'm not saying there won't be any more books. I've got some ideas about, but I just want a couple of years off. Basically, Friday Barnes books are very intense to write and it's very, the pressure of maintaining the quality is intense and it just like, it weighs on me. So I love writing them, but by the time I've written 6, I will be tired and I will need a break for a couple of years. So I'll take a break for a couple of years and then I'll probably come back and set Friday and Ian and Melanie up in another situation. And I'm not sure what that'll be. It might be that they're at university in the next reiteration of the series. I'm not sure. But basically, there'll be two more books, and then there'll be a break for a couple of years, and then they'll probably come back, and they may be a couple of years older. They may not. I mean, some people want me to go back to Highcrest Academy. I don't know. I haven't decided. So two more, a rest, and then we'll see. All right. Next question is from Robin. Oh, sorry, not Robin, her son Henry. And he's asking, how did a pig, so this is a Nanny Piggins question, how did a pig end up with a bear for a brother? So how did Nanny Piggins end up with Boris the bear as her brother? Well, basically the short answer is adoption. She adopted him, so as a brother. And I always like to say when you do when I do presentations, it's like, I know my own brother is really annoying and upsetting oftentimes as well. And you think about it, wouldn't it be cool if, like, you got to have your brothers and your sisters, and they are who they are, and you have to put up with it. But it would be cool if you also got to adopt a sibling of your choice. I just thought that was a cool idea. So anyway, she adopts him at the circus. And in fact, the book I'm currently writing, which is the Nanny Piggins prequel, the Nanny Piggins origin story, I'm currently writing that. That's going to come out in November 2020. What year is it? Four this year. And that's all about Nanny Piggins before she comes to the greenhouse. And that will feature the story of her meeting Boris for the first time and how they got to know each other. So all will be answered in the fullness of time if you read that book. All right. So now this question is from Zali and Felicity. They're people who came to my event once with some people from New Zealand. Some people actually flew all the way to Sydney from New Zealand for one of my events. Okay. So they're asking, are you going to write more books like Hamlet Is Not Okay? We love the book and are excited for more. Oh, well, that's really cool. I love, I'm Pamela. Okay. It's not okay. There's a banner behind me right now if you're watching the video. Yeah, I really love that. That was my passion project in COVID. It actually took me several years to write because I wasn't contracted to write that one. So I was just doing it for fun. So I had to squeeze it in between other projects. And also it was kind of labor intensive because there was a lot of, I wouldn't really call it research. I had to sort of like immerse myself into Hamlet. So I was listening to a lot of different versions of Hamlet and watching a lot of different versions of Hamlet. And that all took a lot of time. And I was reading the play again and again and again. So anyway, basically the short answer is yes. I have also been commissioned to write another Hamlet Shakespeare type book. I've got a whole idea for how I'm going to do it. But the next one will be based on Romeo and Juliet. And I've actually got an idea for doing one beyond that about King Lear. I know Hamlet at the end sets up that I'm going to do King Lear next, but I didn't, when I came to, you know, negotiate my contract, I was like, I didn't have an idea for King Lear, but I did have an idea for Romeo and Juliet. So I said, let's do Romeo and Juliet next. But then the other day I was driving in the car and I had an idea for how I could do King Lear. So maybe if Romeo and Juliet does well, there'll be a King Lear after that. So basically, yes, there will be another Shakespeare book. And I've got this block of four books that I've been commissioned to write in the next 2.5 years, or five books I've got to write in the next 2.5 years. And that is part of that block. So, but it'll probably take a little while. So it'll probably be about a couple of years before that book emerges because my publishers know that people really, really want more Friday Barnes. So that's the one that they're prioritizing. And then we're going to slot this, you know, another Shakespeare in there and the Greek myths book in there as well. Okay, this question is from Oliver, who is 10, and Ella, who is 8. And they're asking, will you make a book called Stories Told by Nanny Piggins? Well, no, if you notice, like, I've got three books which are collections of the short stories from the podcast, and they're called Shockingly Good Stories, Astonishingly Good Stories, and then the podcast was doing really, really well, and the publishers, up until that point, I'd be like, you know, I've got a podcast and lots of kids listen. And they'd be like, oh, yeah, that's nice, Rachel, whatever. And I don't think they really believed me. And sometimes I say, you know, there's like 50,000 people downloading a week. And again, I don't think they'd believe me. Or I don't think they wrapped their head around the concept. But when I got to the point where the podcast had had 1 million downloads, that sort of caught people's attention. They're like, 1 million downloads? Like, really? 1 million? Like, they knew 1 million was a big number. And I'm like, yes. And then it occurred to my publisher, well, perhaps they should name a book after the podcast. So the third collection of short stories from the podcast is called the same name as the podcast, Bedtime Stories with R.A. Spratt, because they wanted to sort of piggyback off the notoriety of the podcast. And they made me write one that was twice as big, which was fine because I had all the stories from the podcast, but it was so labor intensive to edit because every story is really almost like a separate book. And there was like 27 stories in that book. So that was full on editing that book. But anyway, they've said they want another one and they want it to be Greek myths. So we're in discussions about what the title is going to be. I was thinking Greek myths with R.A. Sprat, but maybe it'll be Greek myths as told by Nanny Piggins. I don't know. I'm guessing it's going to be Greek myths with R.A. Sprat. That's what I'm guessing. But anyway, they want to stick with it because, yes, the stories will be told by Nanny Piggins, but they don't want to put off people who might think, looking at the cover, I don't want to read a story by a pig. I mean, only because, obviously, reading a story told by Nanny Piggins is awesome, but people don't necessarily realize that. So you sort of want to trick them into thinking that it's just a really awesome book about Greek mythology. And then they start reading and think, oh, it's about a pig as well. And then they get so caught up in the story, they forget it's a pig. And then they just really enjoy the book. That's kind of what I think we're going for. I don't know. Publishers never actually say exactly what they've got in mind, but I'm guessing it's something like that. Okay. Next question is from Ruby. Okay. Ruby, you've asked a question and the question has a whole bunch of spoilers in it because it's all about stuff from Friday Barnes 12. And Friday Barnes 12 only came out last week. So I'm not really prepared to like read your question because I don't want to spoil it for people who've maybe just bought it and they don't know what's in it yet. But she's basically asking, there's a point in Friday Barnes 12 where Ian opens a door and he starts to say something to Friday and then he stops because he gets cut off. And she wants to know, what was he going to say? So I can't tell you any of the details because I don't want to spoil it for anyone who hasn't read it yet. But I'm going to just give you a try and say without saying, Ian was going to say something that was not bad, but Friday assumes it's bad. So that's about as much as I can say without ruining it for anybody. Sorry, Ruby, but really, I can't give out spoilers a week after the book came out. Okay. Next question is from Sophie, and she's from Toowoomba, and she wants to know, do you think you will ever write another Nanny Piggins book that isn't a holiday special? Well, that's easy to answer because I am currently writing Nanny Piggins, The Origin Story, and that's actually a novel. And, fourth bump of the table. It's really going to be the first Nanny Piggins novel because the first eight Nanny Piggins books, they're novel-like, but they're really a collection of short stories which just have a thin sort of storyline that run between them. So the first and the last chapters, one starts it, then the last chapter ends the overarching story and the stories in between touch on them, but they really are sort of collections of short stories. So this one I'm writing out is a genuine novel. So the origin story. So it is a Nanny Piggins story. It will probably be called Nanny Piggins, The Origin Story. But it will be a bit different because it will be a proper novel. Okay. At least I hope so. I'm struggling to write at the moment because it's living up to everyone's Nanny Piggins expectations it's a big task. Okay. So the next question is from Tora, who's 12, and Shiloh, who's 10. So Tora asks, is the character Peregrine in the case of the smashed statue a reference to the pesky kid's character Joe? No, basically. I would have written that. I did write that story way before I wrote the pesky kids, like years before. That was a short story. That wasn't a short story. That was a chapter out of one of the Friday Barnes books that was cut out of the Friday Barnes book. And I just kept it as a short story because I knew I could use it for something later. And I did. I used it for the podcast. You will notice if you have read every single one of my books, and there are 30 books now, you may notice that the names Peregrine and Perseus have popped up a few times in different books and different series. I think there's someone called Peregrine in one of the Nanny Piggins stories where she goes off and she helps train soldiers at a boot camp. And there's Peregrine and Perseus is referred to on the podcast in The Tall Tales. And the reason for that is because my nephews are called Peregrine and Perseus. And I will admit, they know I know, I think this, I think their names are funny. Because it's so confusing because Perry and Percy is what we call them and their names are so similar. And you've always got to stop and think, which one is which? And it's like, that's not cool. And like Peregrine and Perseus, like Peregrine is such a mouthful to say. And Perseus was like a Greek demigod. Like it's a lot to live up to. And I was just like, oh, my brother. But my brother is a huge Dungeons and Dragons and Lord of the Rings nerd. So when he called his kids Peregrine and Perseus, we were like, oh, Nicholas, what are you doing? But frankly, we were just relieved he didn't call them Gandalf or Bilbo. So it could have been worse. But anyway, that's why you see those names pop up a lot. Oh, there was another question on here, the one from Shiloh. Okay, they said they visited Robertson, which is a town near Barrel where I live, and they saw a big potato statue in Robertson, and it looked like a poo. Is that the big potato that inspired the one in the Pesky Kids? Yes. Yes, it is. We actually, Robertson had their annual show on the weekend, the Robertson show. And I always sponsor, they have potato races where you run around the field with a sack of potatoes. So I always sponsor the girls race, or Friday Barnes sponsors the girls race. And it was really, really good fun. We had fog this year and oh, it was so funny because it's like 400 meters around the course. It's really muddy and it's like that red mud that you get, that you actually, if you buy a Robertson potato and it's not a scrubbed one, you'll see the red mud of Robertson on the potatoes. So anyway, so there's all these girls, there's 14 girls in the girls race, and the girls race is up first. And they've got like 8 kilos of potatoes on their backs. They're wearing all their Friday Barnes shirts because I'm the sponsor. And there's all, off you go. And it's like, you ready, get set, go. And they take off and they start running. They run about 70 meters down the course. And then they just disappeared into the fog because it was such a foggy day. And the race takes about 2.5 minutes. So they disappear into the fog after about 30 seconds. And then they're just gone in the fog. And there's like 2,000-3,000 people watching, just peering into the fog, like trying to pick out where they're going to appear in the fog. And like you're waiting like about 40 seconds, a minute, and then shapes start to emerge from the fog and you can't tell who it is. And the commentators are trying to commentate, but there's nothing to commentate except, isn't it a foggy day? And then they start to, and the girls, and they're running. And it's so hard to run carrying something on your shoulders like that. And it's muddy and it's uneven and they're running. Anyway, the girls did a great job. It was fantastic. They did really well. So there's a girls' race, a boys' race, and then a ladies' race and the open race, which is mainly men, although my friend Sarah does go in that. But it was a really great day because in the boys' race and the men's race, someone fell over in like the last 10 meters, like the winner fell over. In the boys' race, the person who was winning, they did not win after they fell over. And the person coming second in the men's race fell over. Oh, and if you fall over when you're running at full pelt with a sack of potatoes, because you're holding the potatoes, so you can't catch yourself. So you just go splat out flat on your face in the mud. And then the bag of potatoes comes and whoop down on the back of your head, which is just so awful. And if you're carrying the men's sack, which is 50 kilos, it's pretty much impossible to pick back up again. You have to just drag it to the finish line. So it's awful for the people who do it, but it's incredibly funny for everybody watching. All right, let's move on. Next question is from Eamon, Angus, and Owen. And they're asking, are you going to make a Nanny Piggins recipe book? Well, I did have an idea once about making a Nanny Piggins recipe book, and I pitched it to the publishers. And the idea was, it was back when there was just the Nanny Piggins books. And in the first Nanny Piggins book, her sister, I think it's Wendy is her sister, or maybe it's Katarina. Yeah, it might be Katarina in the first one. And her sister is obsessed with vegetables and disgusted by what Nanny Piggins eats. And Nanny Piggins is like a maestro of cake baking. So I said to the publisher, you know, we don't want to encourage kids to just eat bad food. So we could do a cookbook, and it's what they call in publishing a flip book, where there's two covers on the front and the back, two front covers. So if you start from one cover, you read in, and that would be Nanny Piggins' book. But if you flip the book over and opened it, it would be Katarina's book all about vegetables and healthy eating. So you could have a cookbook that was half and half both. But anyway, my publisher said, oh, yeah, that's a wonderful idea, Rachel. But they never had any intention of doing that. When you're a new author, you're deluded and you don't really know how the publishing industry works and you think these things are possible. But now as an established author, I realize you can't get a cookbook published unless you're a famous celebrity chef. And actually, cookbooks cost a lot to make because they have to take all the photos of the food. And that's like when you write a book, there's all you have is like a writer who types up a bunch of words, which you just process with software. That's easy. Whereas if you do a cookbook, you have to get someone to test all the recipes so that you don't give people food poisoning. And you have to take photos of the recipes and you have to get like a specialist to, oh, that's the fifth bump of the table. I have to get someone who can cook them so that they look beautiful, they don't just taste beautiful, and all that would just cost a fortune, and publishers don't like spending money. Like, publishing is not an incredibly lucrative business, so they would never do that. All right. That Eamon, Angus and Owen also asked, are you going to make a Tall Tales book? Well, there are Tall Tales in Shockingly Good Stories and Astonishingly Good Stories, but I think all the Tall Tales were in both those books. I've stopped writing the Tall Tales, you may have noticed. And the reason I stopped writing them is not because I don't like them. I love them. They're actually probably the easiest stories to write for the podcast, was because they very much came from conversations I had with my daughter, Tammy, as she is known on the podcast. And the thing is, Tammy, she grew up. Like, she's 13 now, and she's not that kid who says those things, and we don't have those conversations anymore. She's very much a teenager. She's in year 8. And it's just not the same, you know, like having a conversation with a kid. Like, when we started out the podcast, she had just turned 9. And so the first couple of years, and it was in COVID times, and we were so bored. And also they were doing school from home. So I was forcing them to go out and do exercise. Like, we'd go and play in the back field and throw a frisbee. And I'd make her stop work every couple of hours and just go for a walk or go for a bike ride with me. And we just have all these weird conversations when we're out and about. So those stories very much came from those times, but we just don't have those times anymore. She's busy at school. And also, she just doesn't talk like that anymore. And she just doesn't let me rabbit on anymore and say all my crazy ideas either. So I don't know. Maybe I'll have a tall tale if I spend some time with my younger nephews and nieces. I'm always open to that. I do have strange conversations with small children when I get every opportunity. But yeah, it has to happen naturally. It's not the type of thing you can sort of create out of nothing. I kind of like that those stories, they came out of real conversations. Okay, this email question is from Allegra in Wollongong. And she says, this isn't actually a question, Allegra. It's kind of a suggestion, but I'll read it out anyway. She's obviously concerned about Nanny Piggins and pig rights. And she's suggested that maybe we could all stop eating bacon one day the week. And she's suggesting either Sunday or Wednesday. Yep, I think that's really good. Of course, a lot of people culturally don't eat bacon for religious reasons. And a lot of people just don't eat bacon for ethical reasons. My bestie at the gym is a vegan for ethical reasons because she loves animals so much. And that's all cool. If you choose to do that, good for you. I understand. I do like that you still want to eat bacon 6 days a week. I respect that as well because, you know, a lot of people are very emotionally attached to bacon. I know when I was a vegetarian, for about 3 years. The hardest thing was when you come home and people are cooking bacon sandwiches because they do smell so good. Okay, Sophie, she's asked, this is one of these questions that I get sometimes. It's a very specific question. She's asked, what happened to Friday's Aunt Goethe, who gets mentioned in book one as the auntie who gave her the noise cancelling headphones? I forgot about Aunt Goethe. I make mistakes. I am a human. I am very tired. I have 2 children. For a lot of the time when I was writing books, I was also working, I had a day job working as a television writer. So as you can imagine, if you're writing 2 books a year and touring and looking after 2 young children and have a day job doing something else entirely, writing TV, I was very, very, very busy a lot of the time. And the thing is, for all of you readers, like say you're 10 years old now and you've been a fan of Friday Barnes for, say, the last 18 months. And you've read all the books. So you've read 12 books in 18 months. They're pretty fresh in your mind because you're 10 years old and maybe you haven't read that many books. Maybe you've only read 100 or 200 books in your entire life. But from my perspective, I'm 48 and I've written 30 books. And also, when you write a book, there's lots of bits that you write that then get cut out. So yes, I forgot Aunt Goethe existed, but then there's lots of characters who I created and then, like, the story of the smash statue had to get cut out, usually for reasons of length. Plus, I've written for 35 television shows. So there's all the characters and the worlds that I've had to write for those shows. Plus, I have read thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of books. And I'm always looking after my kids and my kids are getting me to do stuff for them. So my mind is full. I am wildly time poor. I don't get to go back and reread my books from cover to cover very often. When I came back to, when I rebooted with the ninth book, I did reread all the books before that. But you're probably, as a fan, more on top of the detail of what is actually in the books than I am, because I've just got so much in my head. And I'm not really fantastic at the minutiae of detail at the best of times. Like, I'm terrible at spelling. I'm not overly concerned about getting facts right. It drives the editors nuts. So anyway, I probably just forgot about Aunt Goethe, and I'm sorry, but I'm thinking about now thinking, oh, could I bring her back? And I think, no, I really don't see where she would now fit in. But there was when I wrote the first book, I didn't know there would be a second book. I didn't know there would be 12 books. And I'm just trying to write one book. And so I'm just creating characters in my head for the one book. I didn't realize I was setting up this whole world that would have to fill out 12 books. So I came up with Goethe, and she just did not fill in anywhere. And there's just too many characters with the brothers and sisters and Uncle Bernie and Uncle Bernie's wife, Ian's mother. That's enough family, I think. I don't really need to add any more into that mix. Like, it's confusing enough. So anyway, sorry. Next one is from Abigail, and she's from Toronto, Canada. That's awesome. I'm actually going to go to Canada in a bit. My mum wants me to take her to Canada because my mum's a bit older. So I can't do any events because I'm just going to be there to look after my mum. But I will be going to Toronto, well, maybe not Toronto, but a couple of hours north of Toronto in a couple of months. I love that part of the world. Last time I was there, you had an ice storm, and it was so cool because I went sledding on the ice. And it's so cool because you go so fast because it's just a sheer sheet of ice on top of snow. But when you fall off and you hit the ice, it sounds like you're smashing through a pane of glass. It was really, really cool. Okay. Can you hear the Australian birds? That's a cockatoo going over. They just like screech. They're huge birds. Okay. So Abigail is asking, what is your favorite Friday Barnes character? And she says her favorite is Princess Ingrid because she rides horses, and so do I. I love Princess Ingrid. She's very, she's a lot of fun to write. She's actually a lot of fun to voice as well because she's trying to do something very subtle with her. I try to do something very subtle with her accent, but she gets kind of formal when she's been a princess. She's a very fun, but she's more subtle than my other characters. But she's fun. She's got a very, very distinct way of thinking herself. I love all the characters. They all mean a lot to me. I feel very invested with all of them. I feel very protective of all of them, like they're my children. So I don't really like to say who my favorites are. I love Friday and Melanie and even Ian, despite some of the things he does. I'm very fond of Binky, but I do have a soft spot for Parker. Like, Parker is, he just, because he's so easy to drive stories. Like, as a writer, he's fun to install in stories because so much comedy comes from him. The voice. When I first started reading Friday Barnes, when I only had one book, or maybe actually, I don't know that he appeared. Does he appear in the first book? Yeah, he appears in the first book. And it's the case of the missing homework. And I was having to do Parker's voice. And he sort of sounds like this. And he's a real classic. Oh, he's got like a private schoolboy voice. And I would do the voice and I would wreck my speaking voice doing it. So I had to find a way of sounding like Parker, but without wrecking, like giving myself a sore throat. So I always think about that. It was like how to do Parker. And he sort of bounces when he talks like this. It's like, oh yeah, Friday. Oh, would you help me? I'm in a bit of a pickle, you know, so he's fun. Okay. Sean from Riddles Creek in Victoria has asked, have you got a recipe for Nanny Piggins' Octo-Choc chocolate cake? Well, the short answer is no. No, I don't. That's just, Nanny Piggins has the recipe. Someone did come to my event, the book launch for Friday 12th the other day, and they showed me a photo of a Deca-Choc chocolate cake. So Deca means 10 types of chocolate because they'd done the Octo-Choc chocolate cake. But then they'd added two more types of chocolate by adding two types of chocolate. So they'd put Maltesers on top and Kit Kats around the outside. And I thought that was a stroke of genius because that had never occurred to me. So well done them. Okay, Eloise in Sydney has asked, how long did it take to write Friday Barnes 12? Well, that was kind of weird. I usually, like in my schedule, I have 6 months to write each book. But within that 6 months, I often have a lot of other commitments. So when I was writing Friday Barnes 12, I was really slammed for time because I had to launch the Hamlet book and I had to launch Bedtime Stories with R.A. Spratt. And in August, September, in Australia, all children's authors and illustrators are just on the road nonstop for about 6 to 8 weeks, traveling around the whole country doing school visits for Book Week. So Friday Barnes fell at that time when I had to sort of like drop everything and give 100% of my focus to doing a book launch because I did a big in a theater book launch for the Hamlet book. And you have to, I had to do a bunch of social media and a bunch of interviews and stuff like that. And I had to do the same thing for Bedtime Stories. I actually did 3 book launches from memory. I did 2 in Australia, 1 in Canberra, 1 in Sydney, and I did 1 in New Zealand. So that was, you know, a lot of, you know, because when you do a theatrical event, you know, you have to book the theater, you have to travel there. There's a lot of setup. You have to get your stuff together. It's a lot doing one of those book launches. So there was those events. I had to do those events. I was on the road a lot. And within that period, I had to write Friday Barnes and edit it. And I was behind schedule before I even started. I was like 3 months behind schedule. So they were just on at me. Like, they're like, I think at one point they said to me, when can we expect the manuscript? And I hadn't even started and it was like due that week. So I said, look, you know, I'm not going to compromise. I need at least 2 months to write a rough draft and then at least 2 weeks to edit. So I think, but then it was broken up in the middle by book week and I just couldn't do anything for those like 8 weeks. So I think it was like I had 4 weeks and then I had 6 weeks and I did get it together and I'd been researching it. I had the plot like months before I started, but it all came together. But then there was a lot of problems in the editorial process. I was working with an editor I'd never worked with before. I was working with a publisher I hadn't been working with for very long. And we just had a lot of sort of communication, misunderstandings. And then there was a lot of problems with setting it at CERN. They were very concerned about CERN being upset about me setting a book at CERN. So there was just so much like getting bogged down in that book with problems that were nothing to do with writing the book. And so I had to spend all this time dealing with this stuff that took away from time I could spend working on the book. And so, yeah, that book was tough and it came right down to the wire. But we, like literally there's photos of on my Instagram of me doing the final edits as I'm recording the audiobook. So I was picking up copy edits on a physical copy as I was recording the audiobook because it was that close to it being printed and published that we were still making changes. But I think it came out super, super well. And I loved setting the book at CERN. It made it very different. And for me, that book was all about bringing in Friday's family who had only been mentioned peripherally and to give you an insight into why she was the way she was with this family. And also so for her to sort of make peace with it, that's the way her family are. And people don't change very often. And that's okay because they're good people, really. They're just academics anyway. So that's what, I'm not sure if that answered your question, but basically I have 6 months to write a book, but oftentimes I don't have much time within that 6 months, but we got there with that one. It just came close to the wire. Have you ever thought about doing a Nanny Piggins superhero story about her being a superhero or becoming a superhero? Now that question is from Isabel in Quebec, Canada. Well, I would argue that Nanny Piggins is already a superhero. I mean, she can fly. She can do all these amazing things. She can cook at an elite level that, and her pies are so good. They're dangerously good. They can control people, you know? So I would sort of argue in a way she is a superhero and giving her like superhero powers, you could sort of do it as a gimmick. But I don't think I need to. I think she kind of is a superhero already. All right. This one is from Sandvika, and she's from India. And she's asked, does Boris have any other cousins except Nanny Piggins? Well, actually, Nanny Piggins is not his cousin. Nanny Piggins is his sister. That's bang number 6 of the table. It's his sister. She adopted him as her brother. And no, I've never had any other relatives of Boris. Again, I think there's quite a lot of family already. I'm not sure. I am doing the origin story at the moment. And so you find out a bit about Boris, but I think he's basically an orphan. But he was in a ballet company in Russia before he joined the circus. So he sort of sees them as his family before the circus becomes his family and Nanny Piggins becomes his sister. So there are times when people, there is a story where people from the Russian circus do turn up and are mean to him. But no, he doesn't have like brothers and sisters and cousins, at least not yet. But, you know, I always like to leave the door open to these possibilities. Okay, so this is from Jacob in Perth, and he's asking, and Indy, his sister, and he's asking, would I ever do a live performance in Perth? Well, yes, I've actually been to Perth a couple of times. I went to the Perth Festival and the Scribblers Festival. I love going to Perth. Obviously, it's a long way for listeners overseas. Perth is like a five-hour flight, I think, from Sydney, and so it costs a lot to get there. So I love to come to Perth, and whenever I've been invited to festivals and they've paid for my airfares and accommodation, I have gone to Perth. I would like to do a show there. It's kind of hard to organize shows in places that you can't – no, that's not a bad excuse. I've got an idea. I was thinking – I've got my eye on the theater in Subiaco. There's a Subiaco Arts Center. I did a performance there with the Scribblers Festival, and that's a nice theater. That's a good size for me to do a show. So I am thinking of trying to get over to do a show in Perth. Maybe not the Christmas show, but maybe the origin story of Nanny Piggins is coming out in November. So I was thinking of maybe coming into Perth to launch that book there and trying to do a big event at the Subiaco Arts Center in like the beginning of November, maybe the end of October, around then. So that's what I'm thinking. But that's the only reason I haven't been to Perth. It's not lack of love of Perth. It's just it's far and it's expensive and it's just hard, you know, to get away sometimes. So yes, I will hopefully get to Perth before the end of the year. Okay. Alexander and Ileana have asked, what inspired you to choose a pig as for Nanny Piggins' character? Did I think of another animal? And yes, I did. I was a real cat person, which is ironic now because I can't have a cat anymore because when my last cat passed away, my oldest daughter had just been born, so I didn't get another cat straight away, which was a mistake because when I didn't have a cat, I developed an allergy to cats, and now I have a very serious allergy to cats, so I can never have a cat again, so I have a dog. But I was a cat person, and I originally thought when I was trying to – because the idea was I'm coming up with a character who's a nanny for children, and I wanted to be a really awesome, cool character, and my first idea was a cat. But I think cats have very sort of inscrutable faces, like you can't tell what they're thinking. And pigs – the more I thought about it, the more I thought I could do with a pig because pigs are so emotionally honest, like, and they're so clearly driven. Like I said earlier, when you come up with a character, you want to know what makes them think the way they think. And pigs are so black and white. They want food. And as soon as Nanny Piggins smells chocolate, that has 100% of her focus and her motivation. So the more I thought about it, the more I thought I could do with the idea of a pig. Like when you're coming up with a concept, you're trying to think of something that you can mine for ideas for books and books to come. So I just thought I could do more with a pig than with a cat. Okay, this question is from Ishana in Victoria. And she's asking, how do you come up with your stories? Well, the stories for books like Friday Barnes, it's kind of methodical. It's probably more disappointingly mathematical than you would think. I use a whole sort of structure system based on Joseph Campbell's story structure. I usually work out what the action ending is going to be. I work out what for Friday, what her emotional journey is, where she's starting out and where I want her to end up. And then I sort of work out where it's going to be set, and then you sort of work in the narrative to fit within that framework. You usually come up with the end first and then figure out how you're going to get yourself to the end. So you work all that out in advance, and when you've worked it all out, the bits and pieces, and I write it out almost like a giant mathematical formula or flow chart. When that's all worked out, then I start to write it out as a plot, and then when the plot's all written out, then I write it as a book. But I fill it in with ideas. I get a lot of my ideas from reading. I read three or four newspapers a day. I scroll through things on the internet. I read a lot of books. I read a lot of collections of short stories. I'm a very curious person. I talk to people all the time. I'm always fascinated by people I meet. I ask lots of follow-up questions about what they do, how they do, why they do what they do. So yeah, I draw stories out of things I see and hear and read and overhear. But I trained originally as a comedy writer writing about the news. And so I was trained to have an eye when you read newspapers for unusual things and odd things and curious things. And that served me well in writing children's books because, like, I'll read the newspaper. And, like, the other week I was reading about an art criminal who was a professional soccer player. And he was a very successful, wealthy professional soccer player in Norway. But he got into stealing. Like, he actually stole the Scream from the Munch Museum like 20, 30 years ago. It wasn't called the Munch Museum. It's called like the New Norwegian Art Gallery or the Oslo Art Gallery or something like that. But he stole it. He figured out how to steal it. He stole it in 55 seconds by basically running up to the museum with a tall, like a ladder that reached up to the third story, running up the ladder because he was an elite athlete, smashing the window, climbing in, grabbing the painting, going out, because all the security was based on setting off alarms if someone opened the window. But he didn't open the window frame. He didn't push up the window. He smashed through the glass, and the security hadn't considered that anyone would do that. And because he was an elite athlete, he was able to get up the ladder, get in, get out so quickly. And I just found that fascinating, the idea of someone who is so successful in what they do, but they're driven to commit crime because it's fun and the challenge of not getting caught. And that he didn't even particularly care for art or want the art. And so when I read the paper, if I see something like that, I will stop and read the whole article in depth, and I will often print it out because I think there's something fascinating about that, you know, the logistics of how he did it, but also the mentality of what drove him to do it. So ideas I get from all over the place, but things like that in particular, and often just science, twists of science that will allow you to have a surprise ending or an ending that you can figure out by using science. Okay, Molly and Annie May have written to me, and they are wondering if, oh, they're from Ireland. I think they're from Ireland. Yes, they're from Ireland. And they were wondering if I could write, Annie May in particular was wondering if I could write about Nanny Piggins and St. Patrick. And I actually think that's a brilliant idea because apparently St. Patrick's Day is March 17th this year. And so that's really around the corner. So I should get onto it and do that in the next couple of weeks. That's a really good idea. And I was talking to my Welsh friend from the gym, and she started talking about St. David or St. David. And I thought, ah, this is a whole new avenue of storytelling, like the famous saints from each country, but St. Patrick's. And also because St. Patrick, I believe, was famous for driving the snakes out of Ireland, which is kind of topical for me as an Australian because we have a lot of snakes here. I have them in my garden. Only ours are actually venomous, but Australians have quite a sort of complicated relationship with snakes. So I think, you know, there's a lot in that. I'm going to set that aside, and that I will make that happen. All right. Oh, we've been talking for 53 minutes, which is more than and there's still heaps left. Okay. I'll stop at an hour. See how many more we can get through in the next 7 minutes. Okay. Sophie has asked me, what made you love writing and how do you manage your time? Well, I don't really love writing. I have a talent for writing, and I am drawn to it, and I love telling stories. I love telling stories, and when you tell a story to a kid and they get that look in their eye where they know you're talking, you're just making stuff up, but they want to believe you and they go with you. I love that. But writing, you know, I've done this for 26 years and there's so much pressure from the fans and from the producers and the publishers. It's a lot of a weight and it's stressful. And you have to like force yourself to sit down and write. I mean, when you force yourself to do it, then you get caught up in the fun of it. And I love the conversations the characters get into and you get caught up into it. And then you look up and 2 hours have gone by and you've written 2,000 words and that is fun. But it's not love in the way like I love my dog. It's more like I have this strange magical talent that I've been blessed with and have, I wouldn't even say I have control over. It's more like you're a tap that you can turn on and turn off. But it's a double-edged thing where it's exhausting as well and you're pouring your soul into what you write. So you feel drained afterwards. And you feel so pressured because I feel pressured because I love the characters. You want to do justice to them. So there's a lot of I feel a lot of pressure to maintain the standard and come up with things that are good enough to service these characters. So it's work. It's hard work. So love is probably not quite the right word. It's more like a call-in or something. Okay, Ella from Dunedin, that's a city in southern New Zealand, on the South Island of New Zealand, but at the bottom of the South Island, and her brother William, they've asked a couple of questions. William wants to know, how do you come up with your crazy ideas? Well, I just sort of explained that, you know, newspapers and things like that. And Ella has asked, did you always want to be an author? And if not, what did you want to be? Well, no, I did not always want to be an author. In fact, I was a writer for 10 years before I became an author. And the reason for that is because when I was at school, when I was about your age, I was so bad at spelling. I actually read a little bit slowly as well. I probably read about 20 or 30% slower than most people. And I was really bad at essay writing at high school. And when I got to university, my history professor sent me to the remedial English coach because she said my grammar was so bad. I actually went through primary school in this weird sort of sliver of time where they decided not to teach grammar, which I don't think helped. But having been told all this constantly through, you know, 16 years of education, it never occurred to me, having been told constantly that I was so bad at spelling, so bad at grammar, so bad at expressing myself logically in an essay, I had no confidence in my ability to write. So I got a job almost accidentally as a joke writer for a television show. And that when they discovered I had this weird and random talent for writing jokes. And so I did that. And I did that for years. And that, and then I got offered a job writing sketch. It turned out I could do that too. And then my agent got me a job writing for a preschool TV show. And it turned out I could do that too. And I sort of was writing longer and longer forms. And it was only when I'd been writing for 10 years and I was frustrated creatively, only then do I thought, maybe I could have a go at writing a book. And I thought, oh, my grammar will be bad and the spelling will be bad, but I'll get people to help me with that. And it turned out I wasn't that bad. Like after 10 years of writing, my spelling had improved and my grammar had improved. But I actually wrote like quite a fluent, like Nanny Piggins, it didn't take that much editing. I did write a good book. I wasn't that bad. I was bad at writing essays because I'm not good at staying on track and arguing something logically, but I was good at telling stories. And my spelling had improved in my time as a television writer. And my grammar, I sort of wrote the way people speak. And the publishers were able to work with that. And the publishers over the last 16 years I've been writing books have, my grammar has improved as well. It's still limited because my brain just doesn't work that way. But the thing is, to write a book, the skill, the main skill you need is to be able to tell a story and to engage with an audience. And I was good at that. And that's the thing that's really, really hard that most people can't do. So, anyway, it never occurred to me I'd be an author. And I was quite surprised when it turned out that I could actually do it. And I do regret not having the confidence to try it earlier in my career, because my life could have been very different if I'd started writing books in my mid-20s instead of my early 30s. I could have taken off in a different trajectory because I spent a lot of time trying to do other things that didn't work out. And if I, but you know, that's life. Things work out. I've ended up okay. Patrick and Angus, they've asked, what is your favorite element of the periodic table? They're from Canberra and they want me to go back to Canberra, and I will be going back to Canberra. I'm doing a Christmas show in Canberra in December. Okay, so what's my favorite element in the periodic table? This is a strange question, but I love it because I actually do have favorites. I really like, because I studied chemistry. I taught myself chemistry when I was 27. I'd never studied chemistry at school, but I had this brief idea. I was unhappy as a television writer at the time. I was working on a show that it was like an animated show that was not good, and I was kind of miserable. The producers were being a bit mean to me, so I thought, I'm going to pack it in. I'll go to medical school and I'll become a doctor. So, but I had no training in chemistry or physics, and you have to pass a 7-hour exam, four of the 7 hours are science-based. You have to do, actually, no, maybe it's 5 hours, but you definitely have to do a big science exam, and part of it is chemistry, and I never studied chemistry. So I taught myself chemistry from scratch at the age of 27. I just read the HSC textbook from cover to cover, did every answer. And so I have like a strange love of chemistry now, because sometimes when you learn things and you don't learn them at school and you don't have all that baggage of teachers teaching you and feeling bad about your homework, when you learn things as an adult, you just really enjoy them. And I found chemistry fascinating and I loved it. So I was fascinated with gold, which, you know, you think, oh yeah, gold jewelry, but no, I was fascinated with its chemical properties. The fact that it doesn't rust like most other metals will develop rust, even like copper, which doesn't rust much. It gets like tarnish, whereas gold is used for like conducting messages and stuff, because it conducts things really well. It's got all these unique properties. So people think of it in terms of jewelry, but chemically gold has a lot of really interesting properties that make it useful for messaging and using in cables and things like that. But of course, also, so I'd say gold was the first thing I thought of when you said, what's your favorite element on the periodic table? But then of course, mercury, because mercury is the only metal that's a liquid. In fact, it's the only element on the periodic table that's a liquid. Plus, it's really dangerously poisonous. So, which is always cool when you're a mystery writer. Poison is always a cool thing to have pop up. Okay. Now this question is from a 17-year-old. She says she's quite old. She's 17, but she's been a Friday Barnes fan for 7 years now. Well, actually at some of my events, I get like 22, 23-year-olds now, because if they were like 12 when the first book came out and the books have been around for 10 years, and some, of course, Nanny Pickens fans are even older, because so I wrote the first Nanny Pickens book 16 years ago. So if you were 10, 16 years ago, you're 26 now. So I actually get some older fans and adults at my book events all the time. What were the inspirations for the main characters such as Friday, Ian, and Melanie? Well, I already said earlier on about Friday being, you know, the kickoff point was Sherlock Holmes and then all the smart girls I went to selective school with. And then Melanie and Friday, this is actually a tip for you with your creative, when you're doing creative writing. Oftentimes what I do is when I come up with one character who is a very strong character and you need a set of characters, because I always write my books a bit like a sitcom where I have about 5 or 6 main characters. So you have one character, when you know who they are and that's your main character, then your other characters you come up with in relation to them. So I made Friday very scientific but irritating. So I made Melanie very charming, but vague and doesn't follow what's going on. So they're like opposites, because that's really useful when you're writing. So you have the two characters go into a room. If they're opposites, they're going to notice totally different things. And when they talk about things, when they have conversations with each other, they're going to have totally different viewpoints. And that's really, really useful when you're writing to have characters who are different. And then I did the same thing with Ian. So Friday has, she's very drab and she goes unnoticed all the time, and she's short and she's got mousy, nondescript colored, sort of vaguely brown hair, and she wears really drab clothes. So I needed like someone as a sort of a protagonist, an antagonist, maybe love interest. So I thought, I'll make Ian the opposite of that. I'll make him tall and just strikingly good looking and super confident. And she's not very wealthy. He's come from a super wealthy, super privileged background, and has all the confidence from that. So the two ancillary characters were really formed by who Friday isn't. And then that way you get the three of them together. And Melanie and Ian are very different as well. So you get like a triangle of different viewpoints in every scene you have them in together. So that's how I came up with them. Okay, this one is from Robin. And Robin actually says, oh, when in the podcast I was talking about, you know, send in your questions and tell me where you're from. So you could say, I'm Roberta from Papua New Guinea and my question is. And Robin says that her name is Robin, which is similar to Roberta, and she actually did live in Papua New Guinea. So she thought that was funny, and I do too. Okay, and she has asked, how old is Nanny Pickens? Well, Nanny Pickens would say that question is rude and that all people over the age of or women over the age of 30 are 21. I've never specified. I'm not actually sure how old Nanny Pickens is myself, basically. And Robin's son's question is, what is Nanny Pickens' first name? Well, that's easy to answer. Her name is Sarah, is her first name. And actually, her full name is Sarah Matahari Lorelei Pickens. And actually, if you have one of the early first editions of the first book, it does say her name is, I think, Sarah Matahari Lorelei Alice Pickens, or maybe it's Anne Pickens. But then I dropped the Anne or Alice name. I think it's Anne Piggins, Nanny Anne Piggins, because of Nanny Anne became like a bigger and bigger character. And I realized I shouldn't have given the name Anne to Nanny Piggins as one of her middle names. So it's Sarah Matahari Lorelei Piggins. Okay, this is from Alyssa, Toby, Eva, Jack, and Sophie. And they are saying, are the characters in Friday Bounds your real family members? No. No, they are not. Will Princess Ingrid be appearing again? So, yes, she's in, I think it's the fourth book, and she's in the one set in Norway, which I want to say is the 10th book. And I've just – if you've read the 12th book, this isn't really a spoiler, but just at the end I've set it up that her and Binky will be in the next book, most likely. And can you write a Friday Barnes 13 books? Yes, I am already writing a Friday Barnes 13 book. Well, I'm not already writing it, but that I think that's the book I have to write next after I finish this one. No, I have to write Nanny Piggins, then I have to write the Greek myths, then I have to write Friday Barnes 13. It's coming. And then I have to write the Romeo and Juliet, and then Friday Barnes 14. That's what I'm doing for the next 2.5 years. Charlotte has asked, where can you find Nanny Piggins books? And then she's also asked, can you please do a book launch in Brisbane? Well, I did do two events in Brisbane last year. I did the Christmas show and I did an event at Riverbend Books in August when I was up there for Book Week. So I wanted to do the Christmas show again up in Brisbane because it went really well, but I've had a really hard time finding a theatre that's suitable. The theatre I use, it wasn't really quite big enough and it had a bit of a strange thrust stage, which meant that part of the audience was almost behind me, which I did not think was ideal. So I've been trying to find a theatre in Brisbane that sits 300 to 400 people and they're in front of me and has raked seating. And I know you'll probably now email me a list of them. I've contacted them all and they're not available. So I probably won't be able to do the Christmas show in Brisbane this year, but I will be up in Brisbane for the week before Book Week to do school visits. So I will try and set up with a bookstore in Brisbane that I will do some sort of in-store event at one of the bookstores in Brisbane. So there will be a live event where you can come and see me and get a book signed in Brisbane this year, but it probably won't be a theatre show just because I'm finding it hard to find a suitable theatre. Because when you do theatre shows for kids, you really need some very specific things. Because kids are shorter and there'll be adults in the audience, you really want the raked seating so that they don't get stuck behind someone way taller than them. And as I say, I want a lighting setup. I want it to be in a proper theatre where there's ushers to look after the kids, and you want it to be in a nice neighborhood so people are comfortable to bring their kids there. So actually finding a theater that's suitable to put on a live show for children is a little bit more complicated than you might think. But, you know, I'm working on it and I am always on the lookout for a nice theater in Brisbane that will have me. Oftentimes too, theaters won't take a single performance because they have shows in there already that are running for a week. So that there's a lot of issues to consider. It's more complicated than you might imagine. Okay, Neve has asked, what is the mystery romance books Nanny Piggins reads in? Oh, this is a brilliant idea. She's saying, what, you know, in Nanny Piggins, I wanted Nanny Piggins to be reading books all the time because I read a criticism of the Harry Potter books by J.K. Rowling that said none of the characters in Harry Potter ever read fiction, which actually in the later books isn't true because they read Beedle the Bard, which is sort of fiction mythology. But yeah, if you read Harry Potter, Hermione reads all these like non-fiction books, but none of them ever just sit and read a novel. And so I thought, oh, okay, well, people think that's something bad. I'll have my characters. So in all my books, characters read fiction at some stage or another. Even, you know, April in The Pesky Kids, they discover she has a drawer full of romance novels. So what Neve is suggesting is, because Nanny Piggins often reads romance books, is what if the books she's reading are, or she, no, she reads sort of mystery romance books. She's saying, what if the books Nanny Piggins is reading are the Friday Barnes books? And that sort of blew my mind. That's sort of like a multiverse, sort of like going back in time thing, because I wrote the Friday Barnes books after the Nanny Piggins books. But in a way, they kind of are, because when I wrote that Nanny Piggins was reading mystery books, I called them, I think, the Tracy McWeldon books. Nanny Pig was reading the Tracy McWeldon books. And that's inspired by, when I was young, read these books called the Trixie Belden books. And they were mystery books where Trixie Belden was an amateur detective. So that was like a parody of that. But Trixie Belden was very much in my mind when I started to write the Friday Barnes books, because, you know, she was one of the sort of archetypal girl detectives. Solving mysteries with her friends. Like, she's like Famous Five, but she's American and it's set in the Hudson Valley. So sort of in a way, because I was thinking about Trixie Belden when I had that parody in Nanny Piggins, and I would have been thinking about Trixie Belden again when I was setting up Friday Barnes. So yeah, that's an interesting multiverse question. Thank you, Neve. All right, Sterling has asked, I think Sterling would like me to help him with his homework here. He's got to give a 3 to 5 minute speech at school, and he's chosen to make a speech about his favorite book. It has to be about his favorite book, and he's using Nanny Piggins. So he's saying, what would you recommend to make a 3 minute presentation interesting? Well, I would just ham up the whole circus side. Like, I'd start off with, roll up, come and be amazed by the story of the greatest flying pig of all time. What is a flying pig, you ask? Let me tell you. So just ham up the whole circus thing. Pretend you're the ringmaster trying to, get people into a show. Do it that way. That'd be a bit of fun. And just go with it and be silly is what I would advise too, because that's what Nanny Piggins would do. She would say outrageous things, you know, and use plot points from the books. You know, how great is she, you ask? Well, one time she flew over Dead Man's Gorge to protect her reputation as the greatest flying animal of all time, fending off Eduardo, the armadillo, the pretender to her title. Anyway, that's my advice. This is from Ruby. I think this is a different Ruby. And she says, are there going to be more Friday Barnes? Yes, there will. And she also says that Friday Barnes is a banger. And I think that's awesome. Thank you. I like the idea of being a banger. I've never heard a book described as a banger before. That's a term of endearment I associate with pop songs, but I'm proud that you consider me to be a banger. That's awesome. Although for me, I'm old and I'm English, I think of a banger as being a sausage, but I accept that as a compliment in the sense to which it was intended. Sienna has asked me, what is your favourite book? I really love Persuasion by Jane Austen, but that's a book for adults. Don't jump in and try and read it, because I don't want you to read it and not enjoy it. It's all sort of like, it's about love, and some of the language is a bit old-fashioned and a bit hard to sort of get your head around when you're younger. When I was younger, I really loved comedy books, so I really loved Hayden Allison Ashley, and when a little bit older, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I really loved those books and just the way Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy in particular crams in lots of ideas. You will have noticed with my books, I love to cram in ideas. Okay, this question's from Sarah in Dapto. And she says, who is your favorite author? Jane Austen. She wrote Persuasion. I just think she is the greatest. For me, she's the greatest writer in the English language. She just writes beautifully and has such beautiful insight into humans. I love Anthony Trollope as well, because he's regarded as a classic author, but he's just like got a tinge, like he writes romance novels, and he's just got a tinge of the soap opera to him that I really, really love. Which of the book series I've written are my favorite? I don't really have favorites. I really do genuinely love them all. I feel very protective of them all, very fond of them all. So yeah, I don't really have a favorite. Okay, that's the same question from Adele, basically. So hello, Adele, but I've already answered your question. Phoebe, she's the one who suggested that I write the Orpheus and Eurydice story, although I will maintain I was always planning to do it, but it was a brilliant suggestion, so thank you. And she said, how come Friday stopped eating lollipops? Well, I gave Friday the lollipops because Sherlock Holmes had a pipe. Obviously, I'm not going to encourage children to get a pipe. And I just thought it was good for having her kids when they're dressing up at Friday Barnes for Book Week. My idea was, oh, yeah, they could have the hat, they could have the cardigan, and they could have lollipops. And then I could give people lollipops at events. But it just didn't work out as true to the character. So it just didn't stick as an idea. So that was in the first book, but it didn't carry on. And that's sort of like Aunt Goethe. When you set up a series, you have things in the first book that just sort of don't end up fitting with the way the whole series will run. And there's some examples in Nanny Piggins too of things that I did in the first book that I didn't continue to do. And that's just, it's just the way these books are written. I mean, Yeah, because you write them one after another. Like if you sat and wrote all 12 and then edited all 12 and sent them out, these things wouldn't be there. But that's not the way it works. And I don't think that would actually be the best way to write books. So, you know, I'm human. Humans make mistakes and adjustments all the time. It's okay. It's fiction. At the end of the day, it is fiction. Lexi's asked, who is your favourite Pesky Kids character? As I keep saying, I don't really have favourites, although obviously April is an enormous amount of fun to write. And actually, lots of people love Pumpkin the dog, and it's based on Henry, my dog, who's just over here. He's just lifted up his head because he heard me say his name, and I love Henry so much, so I'm very fond of Pumpkin too. Sorry, I'm starting to move through them a bit quicker. Maddie has asked if there'll be any more Friday Barnes books, and we've answered that. Fatima has asked, I was just wondering where one could read an excerpt or first chapter of your newest book, Friday Barnes 12. I don't know. My publisher, Penguin, sometimes has excerpts from my books online. Please, 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 please don't ever illegally download a book online. It's so hard to make a living for authors, not just me, but all authors. Thank you so much for paying for books and audiobooks and ebooks. It makes a huge difference. You know, you're promoting the arts. Books are so important because we're often like the bedrock of creative arts. Like books become movies, books become stage shows and plays. And it's the purest form of art in a way, in that anyone can write a book. Like you just need a pen and paper. Computer helps, but it's easy. You don't need to, like, if you're going to paint a picture, you need to get oil paint. You don't need to know how to use oil paint and everything. But writing a book is such a pure art, and it's so good for our culture to have people telling stories and writing them down and forming this bedrock to our culture. And if we cannot earn a living doing it, we won't do it, because we have to support our families. So thank you to everyone who buys books. You have no idea, just buying a book, how important it is and how much it means to authors. So thank you, thank you, thank you. So when you ask for some free chapters, I think, oh, please just go. Like, even if you borrow the book from the library, if you're in Australia and you borrow a book by an Australian author from a library, that's great too, because the libraries pay authors royalties, and we get royalties once a year from all the copies of our books that are in public libraries and school libraries. So I understand it's really tough for families to buy books. I would argue $17 is not a lot for, you know, several hours of entertainment and promoting literacy, but I understand it is a lot for some people. So then in that case, just go to your library and ask your library if they don't have it, to buy the book or borrow the book, that, you know, order it in so that when it comes in that you get to borrow it. And, you know, please, please do support the publishing industry in our country and in all countries, because it's so important to our culture in ways, in many, many complicated ways. Sorry, that was a bit of a downer of an answer, but it's true. This question is from Eden in Lismore. If Nanny Piggin's distant relatives hadn't invented chocolate cake, what would her favourite cake be? I must admit, I personally love lemon cake. When I went over to England to get married in 2006, was it 2006? Yeah, 2006, I got married in December in England because my parents were living there at the time. I had to go to the cathedral in Gloucester, because to get permission from the bishop to get married in Dursley, my hometown, in England, because I wasn't a full-time resident there. And in England at the time, they had these laws. You couldn't get married in a church unless you were a member of the congregation. So I had to go and live there for 2 weeks and get a special letter from the bishop to say, it's okay, we'll let her get married. So anyway, I went to Gloucester, me and my husband went, and we visited, you know, the bishops. We didn't actually meet the bishop, but, you know, like his admin guy. And we got this really formal, like, calligraphy letter from the bishop saying that I had permission from the bishop to get married at Dursley, my family's long-term home church, where my parents had been married and my grandparents were buried, and they gave me permission. And it was a big deal. And at Gloucester, I believe they filmed part of Harry Potter there and everything. It's a beautiful cathedral. And actually, one of the guys who invented vaccinations, Jenner, There's a statue to him there because he came up with the smallpox vaccination and he was living in Berkeley, which is another town where my family comes from, next to Dursley. So anyway, Gloucester Cathedral is a very impressive cathedral. If you're in the area, you visit. So we had gone down there for the day to get our letter from the bishop. And of course, we're in Gloucester for the day. We got to go visit Gloucester Cathedral. So we go, we look at the statue of Jenna. We look at the beautiful cathedral. We look at the bits where Harry Potter was filmed. And then my husband loves cake. I must admit, his love of cake partially inspires the character of Nanny Piggins. And he's like, the ladies of the cathedral have a church tea shop under the cathedral. I think it was like the crypt where they used to keep the dead bodies or something. They'd made it into a tea shop. And he's like, they've got cake down there. We have to go down. And I remember being annoyed with him and thinking, you are a huge baby that we are in this beautiful city, this beautiful cathedral, and all you can think about is cake. And it's like, I was kind of stressed because we'd been through all this thing with the bishop and I was worried that we wouldn't get the letter and we would have traveled all this way and all the guests would turn up for our wedding. We wouldn't be allowed to get married. And I'm like, oh, is that all you can think about is cake? And he's like, yes, it is. So I'm like, fine, let's go and get cake then. So we go down to this tea shop and they had this cake on the counter. They only had like two cakes and you could have a slice of one of them. And it was called lemon drizzle cake. Now, if you've read all the Nanny Piggins books, you will know that I mention lemon drizzle cake a lot. And that is because this slice of cake that I had in the tea shop underneath Gloucester Cathedral was one of the most sublime experiences of my life. It is so, so, so good. So what a lemon cake is it's a lemon cake. So it's a sponge cake that's been flavored with lemon, usually by putting lemon zest in it. So you get the lemon cake. It's often got poppy seeds in it as well. So it's a lemon cake with poppy seeds in it. And then what you do, this is the special thing you do with a lemon drizzle cake. It's the drizzle element. They make a drizzle, which is a sugary syrup, but because it's lemon, it's still quite sour. And they pour it over the cake. It's sucked into the cake like a sponge. And then on top, they put like sugar, like not like frosting, like the whipped butter frosting, but like icing frosting that's like hard and crunchy. So after the drizzle soaked in and cooled down, then they put this lemon flavored crunchy icing over the top. Well, it's not crunchy, it's like smooth, but when you bite into it, like crunch through it. Oh my goodness. This cake, there was the textures, there was the sour, the sponge, the sweet icing. Oh, it was so, so good. That eating that cake was almost as good as getting married. It was like that. Those are the two experiences I remember of that week, eating that cake and getting married. All right. Well, that was the last question. It was actually a nice positive note on which to answer. This has ended up going about an hour and 20 minutes, so way longer than I anticipated. But I hope you've enjoyed that and I've answered all your questions. Thank you so much for writing. Thank you so much for supporting the podcast for the last 4 years and supporting my work and buying my books. It means so much to me. I love this job. I love writing stories. I love telling stories even more. I'm so grateful for everything, to have this life. And I'm so glad to be able to share stories with people because I believe stories are so important and they're fun, but it's such a fun way to share something that's so primal to the way our brains work, something comforting, something fun that we can all share together and have a laugh and have a bit of a catharsis when the characters all end happily ever after. So I think I better end this now before we go on forever. Thank you all for listening. Next week, we'll go back to regular episodes. I'll write a Greek myth or maybe King Lear, or maybe I'll do Pandora's Box. I haven't figured it out yet, but next week we'll go back to normal episodes. So that's it for now. And until next time, goodbye.